Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll hear the story behind the story of the three-month-long legal struggle behind the March 14, 2009 anniversary protests organized by the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
It was standing room only in the Commerce Department this week, where three federal agencies hosted the first of seven public meetings focusing on how to spend $7 billion marked for broadband in President Obama's stimulus package. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service, and the Federal Communications Commission are in charge of developing and implementing proposals to distribute the broadband stimulus funds. Before the meeting, public advocates shared their ideas about how to use the funding to create jobs and expand broadband access across the country. Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press, said that the funding process should use new and more reliable data to make sure the money is used to bring broadband networks into areas that are truly unserved or underserved. He wants to fund projects that are an efficient use of taxpayer resources and to invest in a world-class high-speed infrastructure.
We want to make sure that if we build a new infrastructure in rural America for the broadband era, that we're not simply recreating a digital divide by building a substandard network that then has to take another leap in order to catch up with the cities and the states where we put the money.
Markham Erickson spoke for the Open Internet Coalition, a group of internet technology companies. He said his group was thrilled with the provisions in the plan that called for open networks, meaning providers couldn't favor or discriminate certain content or services.
The language instructs the NTIA to make sure that publicly funded networks are open, and we believe the open character of the internet marketplace is what has fed the engine of economic and job growth in the information, communications, and technology sector for over a decade.
Former Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi, a Republican who represented a rural area for many years and served on the key House Technology Committee, said he sees a lot of common ground with those across the aisle when it comes to broadband expansion.
My hope is that we can help NTIA and RUS and FCC as they do this by bringing a broad coalition together. Markham and Ben and I may not agree on some issues, but the fact that we can have this conversation, say that this is very important, and then work together to find the solutions or the consensus that I hope can help the agencies as they make these policy decisions. My hope is that it could be done in a way that maximizes the public interest and economic growth of our country.
For the past 6 years, hundreds of journalists, activists, academics, students, and artists have been coming together to build what you might call the New Girls Network, as opposed to the Old Boys Network, at the annual Women, Action, and the Media, or WAM, conference. The next WAM conference will be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on March 27th through the 29th. Jacqueline Friedman is the program director of the Center for New Words, the group that organizes the WAM conference each year. She says the conference has a little something for everyone.
We have a number of sessions that are skills-building sessions, both for journalists about how to use the Freedom of Information Act, how to use Twitter, a conversation with editors, talking about women on the op-ed pages. We also have skills-building sessions for activists and people trying to get message out about PR and using social media and a number of different skill-building sessions like that. And then we have sessions about how to cover certain issues, why HIV is a feminist issue and why the feminist media should be covering it more, how to cover climate change, those sorts of sessions.
The conference kicks off with a keynote panel that will feature the voices of women reporting from global conflict zones.
So we have Peta Thornycroft, who's been covering conflict in Zimbabwe for decades. We have Huda Ahmed, who ran the Baghdad Bureau for McClatchy during parts of the war. And we have Jenny Cortez, who has been covering the conflict in Colombia for her entire career.
But the sessions at WAM aren't just focused on the tools of the trade. There are sessions discussing Black women's invisibility in popular culture, media policy, stories about reproductive and sexual health, and the absence of women in political reporting.
It's a real big tent conference. Anyone who's concerned in gender justice in media should be at the conference. So if you are concerned that women's stories aren't being told or aren't being told accurately by the corporate media or even by the independent media, you should be at this conference. If you're concerned about, you know, how the media works and making it work better to get our stories covered, you should be at this conference.
To find out more or to register for the event, visit centerfornewwords.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Barack Obama is doing to the healthcare debate what he did to the anti-war debate. First, he co-opts the left and then excludes them from the conversation. At the end of the process, the only people at the table are Obama and his good friends on the right. In the case of healthcare, the left represents a majority of the people of the United States, who, according to polls, have long favored single-payer, universal healthcare. But until the very day before last week's forum on health reform, the White House refused to invite even one advocate of single-payer healthcare. It took tremendous pressure by groups speaking for the American majority before Obama's people relented and invited in just two single-payer supporters, John Conyers, the House Judiciary Committee chairman and author of the only genuine single-payer legislation, H.R. 676, and Dr. Oliver Fine, head of Physicians for a National Health Plan. It's not clear exactly what Barack Obama wants, but it's certainly not the Conyers bill. By packing the forum with folks of his own or more right-wing persuasion, Obama created the impression that he anchored the progressive side of the American healthcare conversation, an effect he achieves only by shutting out single-payer advocates. As New Jersey labor leader Ray Stever said, "If anyone should be excluded from the summit, it should be the representatives of the health insurance industry." Just as Obama likes to surround himself with aggressive generals and Bush holdovers so that he appears to be relatively peace-loving by comparison, he loaded up his health forum with corporatists and Republicans who have no intention of taking big businesses' obscene profits out of health care. Conyers and Dr. Fine amounted to last-minute tokens who, after initial rejection, could be expected to be grateful for being allowed in the room at all. Obama is making sure that any health plan that emerges will be palatable to the profiteers, just as his gradual Iraq slimdown is palatable to even bloodthirsty warmongers like John McCain. The left, which on healthcare means most of the public, will be relegated to the sidelines, happy with the little that they eventually get. Dr. Fine of the Single Payer Physicians Group reminds us that Bill and Hillary Clinton also excluded the voices of those who support a single payer system. In the end, the Clintons wound up producing nothing. But the pressures to do something have now become so great we can expect some type of reform at the end of the Obama game. However, he has set the bar so low and weighted with the conversation so heavily in favor of the profiteers, the fundamental system will remain, and with it, the highest health costs and most unevenly distributed health delivery system in the developed world. Unfortunately, we will likely be stuck with the results for at least the next 10 years, just like we'll be stuck with Obama's wars, unless we finally get wise to his game. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We'll now hear the story behind the story of the three-month-long legal struggle behind the March 14, 2009 anniversary protest organized by the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition. A friend of mine quipped a joke. On March 14, 2009, you had two parades that were going on in Chicago. One was of a bunch of drunken people in downtown Chicago celebrating St. Patrick's Day, and a bunch of peace activists in Pilsen and Little Village on Chicago's south side who were marching against war and occupation in Iraq and for peace and civil liberties. Guess which action drew a lot of riot police? To no surprise, it wound up being the peace actions in Pilsen and Little Village. In fact, actually, the actions there, which drew probably thousands of people at least, and a fair amount of attention, and also marked the sixth anniversary of the launch of the Iraq War, which in Chicago holds a degree of infamy because protests around that time actually saw about 18,000 people take Michigan Avenue. Not Michigan Avenue, but they took Lakeshore Drive and tried to take a march down Michigan Avenue, but police wound up blocking them and actually violently reacting against protesters with court actions that are still forthcoming more than 6 years after the fact. What wound up happening is that in the case of the sixth anniversary of the Iraq War, you saw similar kinds of actions by the city, supposedly that was very antagonistic to attempts to even have a march on March 14th, 2009. The background and story about this is very illuminating, and I'd like to share with you an email that was sent out by Andy Thayer of the Chicago, what used to be called the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, but which has changed their name to the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition, a group which has been spearheading a lot of activism in Chicago with regards to anti-war organizing, and also has been now has joined forces with a lot of the immigrant rights activism that's been going on very robustly in Chicago over recent years. There was a very fascinating legal story, backstory behind the march that took place on March 14th in Pilsen and Little Village. In early January 2009, Chicago area peace and immigrant rights activists filed a permit application with the city of Chicago to have the right to march in the streets of Chicago's of the Pilsen neighborhood in Chicago on March 14th, roughly the sixth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. While certain provisions of the city's permit ordinance are fairly complicated, one provision is very clear. With limited exceptions concerning permit applications made right at the beginning of the year, if the city fails to respond by fax or telephone to an application within 5 business days of it being made, the city is obligated to grant a permit following the provisions in the application. This is what happened with our application this year, 2009. The city did not respond in time, and so legally we should have automatically received our permit. Background to this. The various deadlines in the city of Chicago's permit ordinance are far from being minor details. They are there for very sound First Amendment reasons. Anyone vaguely familiar with the history of activism in Chicago knows how during the infamous Democratic Convention of 1968, the current mayor's father delayed consideration of activist permits for anti-war marches and rallies so as to disrupt and thwart the protests. Many months in advance, activists would apply to have permits for events. Many months in advance, activists would apply to have permits for events, only to have the city delay and delay consideration of the permit applications until the activists had no time left to publicize their events. For many years, this made it extremely difficult to do any kind of cutting-edge community organizing in Chicago. Today, even though polls have long showed that the overwhelming majority of Chicagoans are against the Iraq War, our mayor has shown a continual hostility toward anti-war organizers. Given that Chicago has by far the most militarized big city school system in the nation, and that Daley has long been a patsy for pro-war policies of presidents of both parties, his hostility toward us should come as no surprise. The city rejected several other permit applications for anti-war marches on previous anniversaries of the Iraq War and other dates. During hearings in late January and early February 2009, the Department of Transportation Assistant Director Mike Simon testified that during his career at the Department of Transportation, he had processed approximately 18,000 plus applications, of which he had rejected only 20 to 25. Of those 20 to 25, he said that six or more of the rejections were of applications submitted by anti-war organizers involved in the current effort to win a permit. In November 2008 and in early January 2009, activists with the Gay Liberation Network, GLN, who also worked on the permit application for March 14th, applied for two parade permits, both of which the city very reluctantly granted after it had failed to respond to the applications within the required five-day deadlines. As each event grew closer, Police Commander Frank Gross of the Chicago Police Department Special Events Section twice telephoned GLN in attempts to get us to extensively modify our permits. Most of the suggested changes we felt dramatically diminished the impact of our First Amendment messages, and so we rejected them, and insisted that we be allowed to carry forth the protest as applied for. For his tone of voice, we gathered that Commander Groves was not pleased with this result, but knew he had little legal recourse. Fast forwarding to today, as Gross testified in hearings in late January and early February 2009, he knew that aside from the downtown and Southside St. Patrick's Day parades, we were the only other applicants in the city aiming to have a march on St. Patrick's Day weekend in 2009. As a document introduced into evidence in late January and early February showed, on January 13th, one day before the deadline for the city's response to our March permit application, Gross wrote and faxed a letter to Mike Simon insisting that he grant no other parade permits for St. Patrick's Day weekend other than for the two St. Patrick's Day parades. I'll let you decide whether Gross's fax was revenge for our previous permit successes or merely an attempt to address the logistical hurdles caused by the St. Patrick's Day parades. During last week's hearing, in late January and early February 2009, we showed several examples of the city rejecting our applications, claiming that the proposed events caused the city undue logistical problems, and yet granted other organizations permits for events that put far greater strains on city resources. On January 14th, Mike Simon's assistant Rika Wallace, said that she had mailed a letter of rejection to the Gay Liberation Network and to the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition, a letter dated January 13th. On January 15th, one day after the deadline for the city to reply, Wallace testified that she faxed the letter of rejection to us. Subsection J of the city's permit ordinance states clearly that in addition to replying by U.S. mail within 5 business days, the city was obligated to communicate its rejection to us by telephone or fax within 5 business days. It did not, and showing an honesty all too rare in city bureaucrats, Mike Simon testified that a telephone conversation he had with me, Andy Thayer in this case, within the 5-day deadline was neither a rejection nor an acceptance of our application. He admitted that he had not even read the application at that time. When the administrative law officer made his ruling in late January and early February 2009 on GLN's and CAIRC's appeal of the city's rejection of our permit application, that he granted the city the benefit of the doubt on virtually every argument the city made, however absurd. However, on the question of the city breaking the deadline, the testimony of the city's own witnesses left him no wiggle room. The city had clearly attempted to violate subsection J of the ordinance by rejecting our application after the deadline and forcing us to appeal their rejection. This is probably the first time in city history, the city of Chicago, that it has lost a parade permit appeal before one of its own administrative law officers. On Friday, January 30th, 2009, the city filed suit against activists, and though it is now claiming that it wants the whole permit issue resolved quickly, it did not bother to fax the suit to the activists, instead just sending it via first-class mail. On Monday, February 2nd, with the city's suit now live against activists, the city filed in court for an emergency motion to reverse the issuance of our parade permit, the activist parade permit. The city delivered the suit and emergency motion to Bob Bossie of the 8th Day Center for Justice on Monday afternoon and faxed them to Andy Thayer shortly thereafter. The documents insisted that activists appear in court within less than 24 hours to answer their motion, even though this was the first news activists had received that they had been sued. To say that the city was using dirty tricks is an understatement. The city's emergency motion was littered with a few blatant lies and many half-truths about the hearing in late January 2009 that can't be gone into here. The most important issue is that if the judge had granted the motion on February 4, 2009, in order to grant a stay against the ordinance, activists would have been screwed, to quote the email. The permit would have been temporarily taken back, and the city could just then delay and delay and delay, and activists would have, for all practical purposes, been forced to accept a lousy March 7th date and march route or get no permit at all. What happened on February 4th, 2009, in a hearing in Chicago could best be described as having dodged a bullet. It was not a victory, but fortunately it was not a defeat either. Even though there was no real lawyer on behalf of the activists and less than 24 hours to prepare, the city attempted to get the judge to rule today on their emergency motion and hence completely screw activists. They were playing very, very dirty. Fortunately, the judge told them, at least for now. Interestingly, today it was very senior-level city attorneys trying to screw activists. Two of the three attorneys that were faced off were so-called deputy corporation counsel. There are only about six or seven deputy corporation counsel in the entire city, and they are the second in command to the city's chief lawyer herself, Myra Georges. In a strange way, activists should have taken their presence as a compliment from our enemies. They take us seriously enough and are so determined to defeat us that they have sent their highest paid big gun lawyers. In the words of Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Unfortunately, the fact that the city has brought out its big gun lawyers against activists also means that it will take a great deal of courage from our new judge if he is to defy them and rule strictly on the legal merits of the case rather than make a political decision. We have a very strong case, but given the forces arrayed against us, having a strong legal case is not enough. Activists must continue the community mobilization in order to have a chance to win. A follow-up court date was held on February 9th, 2009, at which time the activists were informed that they will have genuine lawyers representing us thanks to the Chicago chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. At that time, the judge might hear arguments from the attorneys about the merits of the crucial emergency motion, especially if the transcripts from the administrative law hearing are available at that time. If it does not happen at that court date, it will probably happen at the next court date after that. The battle over this motion is the whole case, and so it is important to stress having a crowd show up at one or more of the next two court dates. There was a follow-up call to encourage people to attend the follow-up court dates, a call which was heard resoundingly so. The courts were packed by activists each time. There was also a call out for media coverage and for calls to city aldermen to inform the mayor to call off this ridiculous legal battle, as it was called. To quote from the email, "With the city budget a shambles and city workers in vital services being laid off, it is absurd that the city is wasting tax dollars on lawyers, each of whom bills at hundreds of dollars per hour, who are attacking First Amendment rights of community members. A good legal case will only get us so far, and as it turns out, not nearly far enough. If we are going to win, it is absolutely necessary that we not only continue to pack the courtroom, as we did so well today on February 4th, 2009, but that we take every opportunity we can to talk about this protest and what the city is doing to stop it, to our neighbors, our friends, people we know from work and or school. Try to get them to the next court date and try to get your local media involved." A follow-up from that email, which took place on February 9th, did succeed resoundingly. To quote from a press release with the headline, "Activists score big win versus Daley administration over right to march. Peace and immigrant right activists won big late on Monday, February 9th in circuit court when they defeated a City of Chicago emergency motion to put on hold a permit victory that the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition, CAIRC, had won in the lower court. Monday's decision by the circuit court effectively rejected the latest ploy in a pattern of City of Chicago harassment of anti-war activists through permit denials and other legal entanglements. There was one analysis that was published by Chicago journalist Sergio Barreto with regards to City's never-ending permit battle. City attorneys claimed that the presiding judge misinterpreted the city ordinance, but the tactic backfired. And as a result, the whole hearing devolved into semantic hair-splitting reminiscent of the immortal Bill Clinton line about how something depends on what the meaning of is. But Associate Judge Joseph M. Sconza was not having any of it. There is one thing to be said. The city is likely to continue its cold-shoulder treatment of activists. As one of the attorneys for the activists stated at a press conference, quote, "The reason we prevailed was because the city violated a technicality of the permit ordinance. There was no political will to issue a permit, and there still is no political will to issue a permit. So this will continue to go on," unquote. And there was a very real fear that a great victory that was had, a march that took place, was actually the capstone of a struggle that took about 3 months, mostly in court, but also within the court of public opinion and public awareness of the issue, in order to help to cause that to come into fruition. This is something of cause for concern that Chicagoans could take note. The rights with regards to freedom of speech and assembly that we take for granted are and have been under very dire threat, oddly enough, by our own city administrators and officials. And this is something that should be considered by all Chicagoans, and indeed by everyone listening to this, that this is a serious matter and one that should be responded to in a serious matter as well. To learn more about the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition and about the March 14, 2009 protests, go online to www.chicagomassaction.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.